waist was a belt with an enormous metal buckle. The only incongruities on this striking corporal were his hands. Brutish things that one man would liken to paws. As the prisoners stood at attention, the corporal stared. Minutes passed. Then, abruptly, the corporal swept forward, walking with chin high, chest puffed. He looked the men over, Louis thought, as if he were God himself. Down the line the corporal strode, pausing before each man and barking, "Name!" When Louis gave his name, the corporal's eyes narrowed. Decades later, men who'd looked into those eyes would be unable to forget what they saw in them. A wrongness elicited a twist in the gut and sent a prickle up the back of the neck. Louis dropped his eyes. There was a rush in the air, the corporal's fist ramming into Louis's head. Louis staggered. "Why you no look in my eye?" the corporal hissed. The prisoners went rigid. Louis raised his eyes to the corporal's face. Again came the whirling arm, the blow to the skull, the stumbling legs.
"You no look at me."
This man, thought Tinker, is a psychopath. The corporal marched the men to a quarantine area, ordered them to stand there, and left. The men stood, growing colder. Hours passed. The corporal didn't return. The men sat down, shivering. Louis saw a discarded apple box nearby. Remembering his Boy Scout training, he pried a slat from it, fit a stick into a hole in the slat, wound a bootlace around the stick, and began alternately pulling the ends, turning the stick until it began to smoke. He picked up bits of straw mat and laid them on the smoking area. The mat whooshed into flames. The men gathered to warm themselves. The corporal suddenly reappeared, demanding to know how they'd gotten matches. Louis explained how he'd built the fire. The corporal's face clouded over. Without warning, he slugged Louis in the head again. He barked at Louis to put the fire out, then walked away. The corporal's name was Matsuhiro Watanabe. Louis had met the man who would dedicate himself to shattering him. Watanabe had begun life with everything. Born into a fabulously wealthy family, he grew up in luxury's lap, living in beautiful homes, waited on by servants. He attended Tokyo's prestigious Waseda University, studying French literature. In 1942, he graduated, then enlisted in the army. With prominent military officers in his family, Watanabe had lofty expectations for himself as a soldier. But when he applied to become an officer, he was rejected. He'd be a lowly corporal. His failure derailed him, leaving him feeling disgraced, infuriated, and bitterly jealous of officers. He was exiled to the military's lowest station, POW camp. Assigned to Omori and named disciplinarian of prisoners, he arrived seething with resentment. He became a monster. He beat POWs every day, fracturing their windpipes, rupturing their eardrums, shattering their teeth, tearing one man's ear half off, tying another to a tree for days. In the ecstasy of an assault, he wailed, drooling and frothing, sometimes sobbing. In the words of one POW, he was the most vicious guard in any prison camp on the main island of Japan. Both Watanabe's victims and his fellow Japanese would wonder at the source of his behavior. To some it was madness. Others saw something calculating. When Watanabe beat men, POW officers looked at him with terror. Brutality gave him power that his rank did not. He suddenly saw, after he hit a few men, that he was feared and respected for that, said British POW Tom Wade. And so, That became his style of behavior. Two things separated Watanabe from other war criminals. One was his love of emotional torture. He forced men to stand for hours bowing at pumpkins. He ordered a chaplain to stand all night saluting a flagpole, shouting the Japanese word for salute, Kire, leaving the man weeping and out of his mind. He destroyed POW's family photographs and burned unopened letters from home in front of them. He ordered men to violate camp policies, then attack them for breaking the rules. He was, said one POW, absolutely the most sadistic man I ever met. The other attribute unique to Watanabe was his inconsistency. He spun from serenity to rage in an instant. One POW recalled seeing him gently praise a POW, fly into a fury and beat him unconscious, then quietly eat his lunch. After beatings, he sometimes apologized in tears. His regret usually lasted only moments. When Watanabe wasn't thrashing POWs, he was forcing them to be his buddies, inviting them to his room for tea parties. He expected men to respond as if they adored him. Maybe he held these gatherings because they left POWs feeling more stressed than if he were consistently hostile. Or maybe he was just lonely. Among the Japanese, Watanabe was despised for his haughtiness and boasts about his wealth and education. He had no friends. One POW compared the tea parties to sitting on the edge of a volcano. Any misstep, any misunderstood word, might set Watanabe off, leaving him smashing china, flipping tables, and pounding his guests. Even when the gatherings were peaceful, Watanabe seemed to feel humiliated by having had to force friendship from POWs. The next day, he'd often attack the previous night's buddies. He favored a particular type of victim. Enlisted men usually received only the occasional slapped face. But thanks to Watanabe's intense jealousy of officers, high-ranking POWs were in for unrelenting cruelty. A few officers were especially provocative. Some had elevated status, such as physicians, chaplains, and those who'd been prominent in civilian life. Others he resented because they wouldn't crawl before him. These he hunted with inexhaustible hatred. From the moment Watanabe locked eyes with Louis Zamperini, an officer, a famous Olympian, and an inherently defiant man, no one obsessed him more. Chapter 24. Hunted. After freezing in quarantine all night, Louis was led into a vast compound. As he entered his barracks, a POW slipped a cup of hot tea into his chilled hands. Another ladled in two heaping teaspoons of sugar from a sock. To POWs, sugar was a priceless treasure. Louis was amazed that this man had a sock full of it. As he sipped his tea, two officers, Englishman Tom Wade and American Bob Martindale, told him about Omori. In the year he'd spent in Ofuna interrogation camp, Louis had longed to be sent to POW camp, where he believed he'd be well treated. That morning, he learned the truth. Omori, like most Japanese POW camps, was a slave camp. The 1929 Geneva Convention, an international agreement concerning POWs, allowed detaining countries to use prisoners for labor. But the workers had to be healthy, they were to be paid, and the work couldn't be dangerous, unreasonably difficult, or connected to war operations. To ensure that POW officers retained authority over their men, they couldn't be forced to work. Japan signed the agreement, but their government never ratified it. Japan mocked the Geneva Convention, enslaving POWs to support its war effort, forcing them into labor so harsh they died by the thousands. For some 11 hours a day, 7 days a week, Omori's POWs slaved at docks, rail yards, warehouses, and a coal yard. Each rail yard slave lifted as much as 30 tons of goods a day. The only aspect of the Geneva Convention that the Japanese sometimes heeded was the prohibition on forcing POW officers to work. Compounding the hardship was the diet. Rations were meager and of terrible quality and nutritive value. About once a week, a wheelbarrow arrived bearing meat. Spread over some 900 men, servings were thimble-sized, consisting of things like horse intestines and dog parts. Malnutrition-related diseases were epidemic, as was explosive diarrhea, the Benjo latrine boogie, which led men to swallow lumps of coal to slow the digestive waterfall. For unenslaved officers and men too sick to work, rations were halved. Ailing, overworked, and malnourished, many men weighed less than 90 pounds. The saving grace of Omori was the guards. There were a few rogues, but several were kind. The rest were indifferent, enforcing the rules with blows but behaving predictably. There was one enormous exception. Corporal Watanabe. Martindale and Wade were quick to warn Louis about the corporal. He was, they said, a tyrant. He loved to send guards bursting into barracks ahead of him, screaming, "Kire!" then race in to choose a man to beat. Sometimes he leapt through open windows. Because Watanabe eavesdropped on the men and beat those who mentioned him, Louis was told to speak of him in whispers and refer to him by his nickname, the Bird. To get almost anywhere in camp, POWs had to walk within view of the Bird's office. The Bird demanded that men salute the office, even if he wasn't there. He often hid nearby, baseball bat in hand, ready to club men who didn't salute. The POWs devised an elaborate sentry system to monitor his movements, with code phrases like, "The animal is on the prowl." Men were so attuned to him that they instantly recognized the clopping of his clogs, a sound that usually triggered a stampede to the Benjos, where the Bird seldom went. When prisoners arrived at a POW camp, they were registered with the Red Cross, which forwarded news of their whereabouts to their governments. But Omori officials didn't register Louis. They had special plans for him and wanted to keep his presence secret. The American government was told nothing, and because the Bird burned the letters POWs wrote, Louis couldn't tell his family he was alive. The warnings about the Bird did no good. When Louis stepped outside, the Bird found him, accused him of an imaginary infraction, and attacked him in a wild fury. The next day came another beating, and the next, another. The corporal was fixated on Louis, hunting the man he would call number one prisoner. When Louis woke each morning, his first thought was of the Bird. He looked for the corporal through morning roll call, farting at the emperor and forcing down rations. When the slaves were marched away, Louis had no crowds to hide in. The Bird was on him immediately. The one good thing about being an officer in Omori was the exemption from slave labor, though at the painful cost of half the ration. But after Louis's arrival, the Bird lined the officers up and announced he was sending them into slavery at the work sites. When the first officer said this violated the Geneva Convention, the Bird swung his kendo stick into the man's head. The next man also refused. He, too, was clubbed. Louis was the third man. Trying to avoid getting his head cracked open, he blurted out an idea. They'd love to work within the camp, he said, making it a better place. The bird paused, considering. Then he marched them to the 8 Benjo pits, oozing over with the waste of 900 men with diarrhea. From now on, he said, they'd be Benjo slaves, scooping the waste and carrying it to a cesspit. Louis and the others were horrified, but they had no choice. Every day they labored in the waste, sickened and degraded, while the bird stood by. To deprive him of the pleasure of seeing them miserable, they made a point of being jolly. Each evening the enlisted slaves trudged back to camp. The first time Louis saw them return, he learned where that sock of sugar had come from. Omori's POW slaves were waging a guerrilla war against Japan. At rail yards, they switched mailing labels, sending tons of goods to the wrong destinations. They threw dirt into gas tanks. Finding the suitcases of the Nazi envoy, they shredded the clothes, soaked them in mud and oil, and repacked them with notes signed Winston Churchill. They peed on nearly every bag of rice they loaded. In one incident, POWs loading heavy goods onto a barge hurled the material down with such force that they sank the barge, blocking a canal. After an epic effort was put into clearing the sunken barge and bringing in a new one, the POWs sank it, too. When the rail yard foreman became absorbed in wooing a pretty girl, the POWs dashed to the track, wrenched the pins and bolts out, and rushed back to their work. A train chugged onto the sabotage strip, the rails shot out from under it, and the entire train tipped over. No one was hurt, but the Japanese were frantic. They looked to the POWs, who kept working, faces blank. The Japanese screamed accusations at each other. What the POWs couldn't sabotage, they stole. They broke into boxes, lifted warehouse doors off their hinges, raided galleys, and crawled up factory chutes. Scottish POWs who worked in a sugar warehouse ran the most sophisticated operation. They knitted 4-foot-long socks and hoarded hollow reeds, and when the Japanese took shoe sizes for work boots, ordered giant boots. At the warehouse, they stabbed one end of each reed into a sugar sack, then ran the other end into their huge socks, allowing sugar to pour through until the socks were full. Others tied up their pant cuffs, stuck the reeds in their waistbands, and filled their pants with sugar. Each evening, Louis saw the slaves walking in, clothes packed with booty. During inspection, while the guards' backs were turned, men would deftly pass stolen food or the men bearing it around. The biggest trick was hiding the POWs who arrived staggering drunk after chugging down stolen alcohol. The drunks were shuffled to the center and braced between sober men so they wouldn't pitch face first into the guards. In the barracks, Louis watched the men unpack. Sugar-filled socks hung from necks, under armpits, down pant legs. Salmon emerged from sleeves, oyster cans from boots. Legs were swaddled in tobacco leaves, which Louis helped hide in secret wall compartments. Then, once dried, shred into smokable bits. One American built a secret compartment in his canteen, filling the bottom with stolen alcohol while the top, upon inspection, yielded water. One group stole the makings of a cake, only to discover upon baking it that the flour was cement. Thieves were often caught, and when they were, all slaves were beaten with fists, bats, and rifle butts. But the men were fed so little and worked so hard that they had to steal to survive. They set up a university of thievery, in which professors, the best thieves, taught the art of stealing. When the Japanese caught thieves, POW officers suggested that the culprits be transferred to work sites where there was nothing stealable. The Japanese agreed, and the inept thieves were replaced with University of Thievery alumni. A black market of stolen goods flourished in camp. With so many men, there wasn't a lot to go around, but everyone benefited. Stolen food, especially the Scots' sugar, was the camp currency. The sugar barons became the rich men of Omori, even hiring assistants to do their laundry. But they donated a fourth of their loot to sick and starving POWs, including Louis.